Greetings and welcome to the Journal of Southern Religion podcast. My name is Art Remillard. I'm the book review editor for the JSR and I teach at St. Francis University in Loretto, Pennsylvania. Joining me today is Tracy Thompson, a journalist, book author, and editor who has reported for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and the Washington Post. We will discuss her most recent book, The New Mind of the South, published by Simon & Schuster in 2013. Tracy, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start with the title because it is an obvious nod to Wilbur Cash's 1941 classic, The Mind of the South. Can you tell us what this book, what Cash's book meant to you and how you wanted to build on it for the 21st century?
Well, Cash's book is one of the books that you just have to read if you want to know anything about the South. And he was a genius for capturing the moment that he was writing about, which was 1939, right on the eve of World War II and some enormous changes that began in the South around that time. And I saw what he did, and I saw the way he did it, and it was a huge influence on me. At the same time, I think Wilbur Cash would be the first to agree that the South has changed so much several times over since he was writing that there was no way his book would be totally relevant to today. What he brilliantly captured in 1939 certainly informs our view of the South today, but it no longer really reflects reality. So that's what I was thinking. I was I thought it was kind of a nervy thing to do, to try to take on what he had done, but you know, I decided to try to be audacious about it.
Now, you intentionally did not reread this book while you were writing your own book. Why is that?
Well, because I wanted to try to push as far into the future as I could. And there is so much about the South that is mesmerizing that I knew already from personal experience. I fell down the Civil War rabbit hole when I was doing research for this. You could easily spend years just researching issues relating to the South and the Civil War. Plenty of people have spent careers on it. And I just wanted to take what I had gathered from his book and use it to move forward. I also didn't want his style to influence me too much. He had a very discursive kind of lawyerly, a lawyer making a closing argument kind of style, where it's almost as if he's talking to a jury and anticipating questions that they might have and stuff like that. And I didn't want to be unduly influenced by that either. I wanted it to be my own thing. It's just such a seminal work. I didn't want to fall too much into its sway.
Well, let's move on to Asheboro, North Carolina. And this is really an interesting place to start looking at the way the South has changed because immigration is very present here. Can you talk about what you found when you went and talked with students there?
Well, it was interesting that the students, the Hispanic students I talked to in Asheboro were, for the most part, U.S. citizens. There were some there who would qualify for the DREAM Act in that they had been brought here as very small children by their parents, who were almost all of them had entered the country illegally at some point during the 1980s. And yet these were all kids who had been born in Asheboro, who talked with a slight Southern accent, also heavily influenced by Black vernacular. And yet when I said to them, "Do you consider yourself Southerners?" they looked at me like I was nuts, because to them, they're living in the North. And they're like one text, one phone call away from the folks back in Mexico, the extended family they left behind. So that just did not compute to them. They also had stereotypical mental images of the South. To them, the South was cotton fields and Jim Crow and, you know, white supremacy and that sort of thing. And that didn't have anything to do with their lives. And yet, I could see some aspects of the South affecting them, whether they realized it or not.
One of the things that struck me was how the life that some of these folks left in Mexico was actually quite similar to the life that they were living in the South. There was even that story of the mayor who went to that town.
That was the police chief, actually.
Oh, it was the police chief, yeah.
Yeah. There had been a kind of a cultural exchange program because the folks in Randolph County are actually very progressive and forward-looking in their way of dealing with immigration. They had sent some folks from the city back to the area of central Mexico where a lot of these people had come from. And this guy was telling me that he was struck by the fact that except for the volcanoes, which North Carolina doesn't have, it was so much like the North Carolina of his boyhood. It was small farms, a lot of people who were subsistence farmers, poor people, but they never really lacked for stuff to eat because they grew their own food, dirt roads. The landscape was similar. The agrarian culture was similar. The same emphasis on extended family, same cultural, social values, church going. It was very similar to him. He said he felt really right at home.
Well, that's an interesting place to kind of go from here, because with this population, we're seeing the South of the 21st century, which can be very diverse and complicated. But in July 2008, you went to a convention of the Children of the Confederacy. And so this brings to light an older version of Southern identity. Could you tell us about this experience?
Well, I started actually with the whole lost cause stuff. I said earlier I fell down the Civil War rabbit hole. I grew up in an era, I grew up in suburban Atlanta of the 1960s, and so the history that I was given was very much a version of the whole lost cause narrative, and the chief elements of which were that the South had not fought to defend slavery. The slavery didn't have anything to do with the war. We fought to defend the principle of states' rights, that the South was a united front against the Yankees, who overwhelmed the South by just brutal force, and that slavery had not really been all that bad. And, you know, that was the version of the past that I grew up with. So growing up with that, you, especially in the era of the civil rights movement, you begin to notice there's just some things that don't fit. And so very early on, I started to question this version of the past that I'd been given. And at the same time, I was aware that a lot of people accepted it. And I think, you know, the recent thing with Paula Deen, one of the things that she said in one of her interviews was, well, you know, slavery just wasn't that bad. We regarded these people as like our family. and that's just sort of a clueless version of what that period of history was all about. But it's very, very common, even now. And so I went to two conventions, actually. I went to Daughters of the Confederacy, United Daughters of the Confederacy, and then the Children of the Confederacy. And it's just a, you know, it's a version of the past that people are stuck on, and that they kind of depend on alternate versions of history. They depend on very suspect sorts of assertions, like that there were hundreds of thousands of black slaves who fought for the Confederacy, things that may have a tiny glimmer of truth in them, and that there were many thousands of black slaves who were digging trenches and put to work by the Confederate Army, but that don't really have any connection other than that slim fact with realities. And I was right in the middle of a whole nest of these people. They were really nice people. They were very, very friendly. And at the same time, I felt like a spy, you know. It was a weird feeling.
Well, in one of your spy moments, you had a conversation with a woman from the UDC who said that her granddaughter had married a black man. And mm-hmm. This wasn't something that she was excited about, but used this as an entry point to talk about interracial relationships.
Yeah, I mean, she kind of mentioned this after we had talked for 10 or 15 minutes, and I guess she felt like she could open up a little bit, and I was struck. I mean, I thought she was kind of honest about her reactions to it. She was not thrilled at the prospect, and yet, after her granddaughter married this man, she grew to like and respect him, and he was, at that point, a member of the family. So I thought that was a great example of real life overcoming racism, or at least making a serious dent in it. So it was just interesting. And it also made me think that if this is happening among this particular demographic, then we're looking at a real sea change in racial attitudes in the South.
And part of this discussion of race feeds into what you call a shadow history that mm-hmm. you have seen And you talk about really witnessing this back in 1982 when you were a reporter in Walton mm-hmm. County, Georgia. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I had gone to Walton County to cover an inquest into the death of a young Army soldier named Lynn McKinley Jackson. I was a very new reporter, didn't really know what I was doing, but I was at least, you know, open to what I was experiencing. What I didn't know at the time, and this is a good example of why I call it a shadow history, because it was worldwide news at the time it happened, and yet somehow or the other, I had never heard of it. Walton County was the scene of the last group lynching recorded in the United States in the late 1940s. I think it was 1947, but I'm not totally sure about that. And every black person, this young Army private was black. Every black person in that courtroom knew that story. Very few white people did. Even my editors, if they did know about it, they never mentioned it. And I remember this young man was found hanging from a pine tree way up in the air, a pine tree that didn't have any branches on the lower part of the trunk. So somehow or the other, if he committed suicide, which is what the jury inquest decision was, he had managed to shimmy up that tree wearing a pair of sneakers. And, you know, it's a cold case. I don't know if anybody will ever totally get to the bottom of it. But I do remember that when the jury came back and said, we find that the deceased died by suicide, there was this collective no that rose up from everyone in that courtroom. And it was just this eerie experience. And I thought, I don't know what's going on here, but there's obviously stuff here I don't know. And that's when I set about looking up some of the history. The major piece I found about it was a piece written in The New Yorker at the time by Rebecca West. I mean, this was not exactly an obscure story at the time. But there are stories like that all over the South of lynchings and this kind of organized racial violence that happened in the early, I would say in the last few decades of the 19th century and first three or four decades of the 20th century, and they peaked around the time of World War I, that white Southerners of my generation, and probably younger white Southerners too, simply have never heard about. They're not in the history books, they're not mentioned, and yet they happened, and they influence things that go on around us to this day.
And they influence things like what you talk about are these residential integration wars in Atlanta that become part of this language of rights, and even tell us something about evangelical Protestantism that you would witness. Can you talk about that some?
Yeah, the 1964 presidential race was the big turning point in Southern politics when the South began to shift Republican. And I remember that because my dad was very much a part of that phenomenon. He was a Goldwater Republican in 1964. But the whole issue that the South was dealing with there was an issue of how to define rights. To Southerners and to basic conservative thought, rights is a concept that attaches to individuals. And what other people were trying to say at the time was, well, no, but it attaches to groups too. And so Southerners, for instance, were being told that they couldn't enforce real estate covenants that restricted the sale of homes to certain racial groups. They kind of could live with that because even though they may not have agreed with integrated neighborhoods, they could still understand that the government shouldn't be able to tell a man what he could do with his own house. But when the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and 65 started to come down the pike and they were being told, well, no, you may run a hotel and you may run a restaurant, but you cannot decide who you're going to serve. You cannot restrict certain groups of people from being served in your establishment. That all of a sudden didn't make sense to them. To them, they were being the victims because their rights to do what they wanted to do with their own property were not being respected. They didn't get the whole sense that other groups of people in a democracy also have rights, to the right to be treated the same as everybody else. So it's funny because at that time, the fundamentalist church I was going to, you could sort of hear this general air of grievance taking over things. It was like a political slash religious. It was where politics really began to enter into Southern religion in a way that I don't think it had before. Because up till then, the folks who were Southern evangelical religion was not a threatened institution in any way. It was sort of part and parcel of the whole ruling elite, at least as far as white Southerners were concerned. But this time, for the first time, they began to see their rights, quote-unquote property rights, being threatened, and it was a whole new world for them, and they felt it was scary.
Now, you witnessed this sort of entwinement of religion and politics when you visited a Baptist church in Mississippi, and this also reinforced a message that Sam Hill had put forth in an article that he actually wrote for the JSR that you make mention of. Can mm-hmm. you tell us about this experience in this church and why Hill came to mind?
Well, he came to mind because he had made the point that he thought that the fundamentalization of evangelical religion in the South had changed the South as much as the civil rights movement had changed the South. I'm not sure if he even thought that he could totally back that up, but I think he was onto something, because it used to be that evangelical religion in the South was pretty much the same whether or not you were a Methodist or a Baptist or a Presbyterian or whatever. It was the same core sets of belief. And the fundamentalist church, which I grew up in, I wasn't even aware that it wasn't Southern in origin, because it was just so much like the Southern Baptist Church that my cousins in Tennessee went to, and like the Methodist Church my high school friend Jan went to. I couldn't really tell any difference. But the fundamentalist emphasis on be ye in the world but not of it, and you know, we have to keep ourselves pure, that sort of thing. That sort of melded with this emerging conservative mindset, and so it became this sense of, instead of the church kind of defining a whole region, it became a church of like-minded people, very much in the same way that the Republican Party in the South became kind of rigid and ideological about things. And so when I went to this church in Clarksdale, it was a Southern Baptist church, and I was feeling nostalgic, and I thought, well, I'll go and sing some old hymns and it'll be like the church of my youth. But it wasn't. It was very much a sense of, you have to be careful about what kinds of Christians you associate with, because some of them are not real Christians, they're fake Christians. And that was just not a message I ever would have heard growing up.
Well, in addition to religion, you have a discussion about the agrarian way of life. And I love this point that you make, where you say, you know, we've never heard of a big city Southerner. That really resonated. So what did your visit to Mississippi also tell you about this lingering theme of the agrarian way of life and community in Southern identity?
Well, I think the sense of community and Southern identity comes out of the agrarian culture. It survives the agrarian culture because it's very much present even today, and the South is no longer an agrarian region. But I think that that's where it came from. I think this is something that all agrarian cultures have in common. It's the nature of agrarian culture, whether you're talking about rural Mississippi or rural China. The thing that made it unique to the South was that it was taking place in a particular historical moment and in a society that was struggling with issues about race. And so you had this agrarian culture that coexisted with a pervasive evangelical religion. I'm talking about pre-1970 South, and which was bound by assumptions of white supremacy, or by a sense of realizing that there were aspects of that which were hard to reconcile with Christian faith, but you just didn't think too much about that. It was bound in the black church by the need for solidarity and community in the face of oppression and being a minority. And also, it was bound by the sense that the outside world as a whole looked down on the South and thought of Southerners as being stupid and uneducated and racist. So it was all these things. And it was like a pressure-packed version of this kind of agrarian sensibility that you find anywhere. It just became extraordinarily strong in the South of that time and place. And I think that's what makes Southern sense of community such a strong thing, even today. I mean, when you go off to Paris or something and you meet somebody who's from Mississippi and you say, oh, well, what part of Mississippi? And you immediately try to find some common acquaintance or, you know, some shared piece of geography or whatever. One of the tests of a group identity, is that you know each other when you see each other in another place. And Southerners always do that.
They have the Southern sonar, is
yeah.
what you call it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, let me finish by asking you a question that you pose at the end of your book. So what does it mean to be a Southerner in the 21st century?
Well, I think that it means that you are aware that we do not live in a post-racial society. And I think you're aware of it in ways that people from other parts of the country may not be. It's also the case that you may not be aware of it at all, that there are people in the South who have kind of caught up to this moment. But I think a lot of Southerners who are of my generation who grew up watching the Civil Rights Movement are aware that this is a country that struggles with race, and that the South is where the values, the ideals of democracy met the reality of race and didn't always come off so well. So we're aware of this country's struggle with race. We're aware of the fact that the South has not always had, if you were a Southerner, you didn't always have a straightforward American identity. You had to think about what it meant to be an American. And I think the South today is struggling to come to terms with a whole lot of ethnic diversity, bearing down on it in the form of, you know, increased urbanization and people moving in, and the black remigration to the South, which has changed places like Atlanta in just some amazing ways. So it's a whole bunch of things, but I think the main part of it is a Southern sense of community that has so far managed to survive. And that, I think, is the crux of what it means to be a Southerner. Now, how that gets expressed in the future is anybody's guess.
Well, that's a great place to conclude this podcast. Again, the book is The New Mind of the South. To learn more about the author, please visit her website at tracythompson.com. Make sure to check out her highly entertaining blog, which is called The Blockhead Chronicles at theblockheadchronicles.blogspot.com. We have links to both at the JSR site, jsr.fsu.edu. Thanks to Tracy Thompson for joining us, and thank you for listening. Have a great day.